When you get the Planet Fitness Black Card, you can bring a friend anytime you work out. And now through March 13th, get your first month free when you join. You heard that right. Conquer the stair climber with your partner in climb. Enjoy a post-workout recovery session in the hydro massage. And do it all again with access to any of our 2,700 convenient locations. So, you coming? Get your first month free and all the perks with the PF Black Card for just $1 down, $24.99 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends March 13th. See club for details.
Let's find a conversation between your soul. Let's find a conversation between your soul and the night.
Hello, Prestige Heads, and welcome to American Prestige. I'm Danny Bessner, here as always with my friend and comrade, Derek Davison. And we're very excited to welcome back to the podcast today, Jessica Pischko. Jessica is an independent journalist as well as a lawyer, and she's also the author of The Highest Law in the Land, How the Unchecked Power of Sheriffs Threatens Democracy. Jessica, thank you so much for joining us again.
Oh, thanks for having me, guys.
So I guess the first basic question is, what made you want to devote so much time to studying sheriffs? For people who are unaware, who are sheriffs? Where did they come from? Why did you want to write about them?
So I will say, when I first started working on and writing about sheriffs, everyone told me it was pretty silly. So I understand why people might have questions. You know, the idea of working on a book about sheriffs really came to me. I was living in California, and some people may or may not be familiar with this, but California was forced to reduce their prison population because the Supreme Court said they had to. So their prisons were stacking up, you know, 150% capacity. And what the state decided to do was send some people serving prison time back to county jails. So they said, they called it realignment. So they said, okay, what we're going to do to reduce overcrowding in the prison was send more people to county jails, and we'll give money to these people and they can decide what they want to do. So it was sort of like, well, you could decide how you want to spend this money. And the person in charge of all of that ended up being the elected county sheriff in each California county. And so right away, it became evident that every elected county sheriff had different ideas of what they ought to do. And that what most of them opted to do was take that money and build very large jail facilities. So they said, okay, we need like bigger jails to hold all of these people. And, you know, if you, to kind of, as this experiment kind of went along, to be perfectly honest, a lot of bad things started to happen in these county jails. They were poorly managed. There were lots of people dying, some from medical neglect and some from fights inside. And the sheriffs always kept, you know, blowing it off, saying like, well, it's not our fault. It's because we're getting these people from state prison, and these people from state prison are in some way, you know, superhuman hardened folk. And so it can't be helped. And that got me interested in why there's an elected, basically police person who does both policing and jailing, which I think is the most important thing about sheriffs. They're elected on a county level, so basically just like your district attorney, and they serve the entire county. In some counties, they do a lot of policing, right? Like the LA Sheriff's Department will be pretty well known to most people, right? Some places they do a lot. Some places they might do less, but in almost every place they run the jail. So they control kind of in essence like the inflow of people going into the prison and criminal legal system, right? They're deciding who is going to get booked into jail. What are we going to do about people who might be immigrants? How are we going to handle people potentially eligible for deportation? You know, what are we going to do about people who have drug use disorders? What will we do with people who are houseless? And so they become this site of where a lot of policy is made, but the policy is getting made by one person, not like policy getting made by, you know, your county council or, you know, and not sort of argue that necessarily good policies get set by these councils or like committees, but you have just one person, and that one person is a cop. So when there's a problem, they just keep hitting the big red button that says, you know, more incarceration, more incarceration, more incarceration, right? That's, they only kind of have like one button to hit.
So a couple basic questions. Do all 50 states have sheriffs? Or is this an artifact of the American West? And then after those two basic questions, what is the history of the sheriff? How did we come to arrive at this unique, or is it not unique, police-esque force?
So almost every state has sheriffs. The ones who don't are Alaska, Hawaii, Connecticut, and Rhode Island. Alaska and Hawaii actually don't have counties. They just have, so they, for that reason, they don't have elected county officials. And Connecticut actually got rid of their sheriffs about maybe two decades ago at this point. So the sheriff is kind of an interesting job. Sheriffs themselves have a story about where they come from, right? So if you ask a sheriff, they'll say, well, this is a job that came from England. It was called the Shire Reeve, right? And the Shire Reeve was like the sheriff of Nottingham. In essence, a tax collector, right? They didn't really, I mean, there was really no need for large, like, police forces. We didn't have, you know, people did not have that kind of policing mindset in the, you know, 1300s to 1400s. That's not really how things worked. And so there was, though, often like this county official whose job was basically to collect people's taxes. And then the sheriffs will say, well, then this job got imported into the United States. And then, of course, the United States made that job better because they made it elected, which is, you know, in the kind of U.S. history, right? The U.S. has like the ability to improve upon Anglo-Saxon traditions by making them like feel more egalitarian. So the interesting thing is I looked into this story. It's actually kind of hard to say whether it's true or not. What does seem to be true, and this is kind of where I mostly trace the importance of sheriffs, which you allude to, which is like the American West, or the growth of the idea, at least, of the American West, because sheriffs were around some places to some degree. They were mixed in with lots of smaller law enforcement figures, and some still exist in New England. Like, there's constables, there's like town watchmen, right? There's all these sort of like petty police entities that did various forms of like policing. But sheriffs really kind of started to take off basically during the time of President Andrew Jackson. And so President Andrew Jackson was...
So it's the 1820s for people. Yeah.
Yeah, the 1820s. So he was a soldier, right? He was big into westward expansion, and he was big into Native American genocide. And he also had this kind of like populist egalitarian spirit, right? So Andrew Jackson had this idea, which was, you know, in combination with basically building the American empire, right, and displacing people, he also felt like there should be more egalitarian democracy, right? He had this idea like, well, we need more democracy. We ought to have more elected officials. And so the elected sheriff became one of those offices, right? And of course, when Andrew Jackson's talking about like more egalitarian, right, he's really thinking of things like the yeoman farmer, or kind of what we would call now like working class white men, is kind of the folks he was going for, right? He really wanted to see the rise of the political power of the working class white man. And electing a sheriff, he saw as one of those ways. You know, as a result, during that time, you know, in the early 1800s, there were a lot of wars. Andrew Jackson was also like very big into war. And I think that sometimes when we talk about the American West, it sort of elides like how much war was going on, right? There were wars against constant wars against Native Americans, war against Mexico, wars, you know, the Spanish-American War. So when these wars, you know, there was a constant state of war. And as these wars died down, there were a lot of ex-soldiers in the American West, right? Like these ex-soldiers were kind of running around the West, They had nothing to do. They were sort of like, well, what are we going to do? There's no war. Who are we going to fight? And a lot of those people became sheriffs, or kind of the form of policing, sheriff policing they had, which was like posses, this kind of like loose-knit kind of military style policing, right? That they, because they were ex-military, they thought more like a militia. Like, we would ride on horses, you know, we ride at dawn to go get the bad guys and chase them out of town. And that's kind of a style of policing that was different from what people did largely in New England, which was kind of more of like a town watchman who like rang a bell or played a little trumpet or something like that, right? This was, it was like more a warlike mentality.
And so how do they relate to the police? And then I do want to kind of go through and talk about sheriffs as politicians and all these other things, but how do sheriffs relate to other types of police? Are there towns that have only sheriffs? There definitely are. But in general, what is the relationship in a place like LA, mm-hmm. where there's the LAPD and there's also LA sheriffs?
So usually in most places, the city gets to set up a police department if they want to. So what happens is a city can say, we want our own police department. They put up the money for it. They hire officers. They hire a police chief. And in most places, you can hire a police chief from anywhere, right? So you'll see like police chiefs go from, you know, Oakland to Dallas to Baltimore, right? They're sort of like a professional CEO class, right? Police chiefs kind of belong to this sort of, and many of them are, right? They tend to be more educated. They belong to sort of like a more elite class. As a result, they also tend to be a little more racially and gender diverse because they are this, like I said, professional style class. Sheriffs, now, if you live in a county, anything that's not in the jurisdiction of the city police will usually fall to the sheriff. In LA, they have particular situations that they call contract cities, which is really just like, and this is what they do in Compton, for example, or East LA. They pay the sheriff to be their police. And it's literally an a la carte menu. Like, you order like two cars with two people in it to drive around between, you know, midnight and 6 a.m. Like, it's like a negotiated menu of services. And then the sheriff provides that negotiated menu of services. What that does mean for those cities is that they don't get much control over the policy, right? They don't get to pick who's hired. They don't get to pick what their policies are. Like, and that would be policies in terms of like, oh, what's their policy on traffic stops? What's their policy on, do they do police chases or not police chases? You know, like, how do they handle use of force? These sorts of things get now controlled by the sheriff's office. And because sheriffs are elected, I think the other big thing that they pride themselves on is that they're not of the elite class, right? And you kind of hear this in their rhetoric, like, they're local. I think around 80% of elected sheriffs went to high school in the county where they work. So if you think about that, like, an intensely, you know, local, hooked into the local political power, knows the best, you know, car dealers in town, understands where people go to church and where they go to school. And so they see it as like a different kind of policing, right? A more populist form of policing, if you will, which is to say like, oh, we understand the people here. We're not sort of like fancy pants cops who like, you know, have to read, you know, the best practices of policing. We know the people. And so we sort of make decisions that are in the best interest of our people that we know the best.
So there's a sense of locality and the sense of real community, which I could imagine could actually, in some instances, lead to more abuses. So there's a lot of ways to talk about the sheriff. Let's start with what you term the sheriff as politician. What do you mean by that? And maybe you could take us through the process about how sheriffs act also, like I would imagine many police do, as politicians themselves.
Yes. I mean, I think since I finished the book, one of the things I feel have thought about more frequently is how all police and all law enforcement are basically like lobbyists. I mean, most people's interaction with government, especially if you are poor, is going to be a police. Like, it's almost like the first person you will ever meet who works for your local government is the police. So whatever that police person says to you probably will reflect you know, it will have a big impact on how you feel about your government, right? Like if the police are arresting you or not arresting you. Now, sheriffs in particular have this really unique role because they are elected and because they must run for office. So most run for office every 4 years, just so people know. So it's like this general, they run every 4 years. Most elections are off cycle, as are a lot of local elections. So it has a tendency to depress voter turnout because it would just be too simple to have every election every 4 years to maximize voter turnout. They don't want to do that. So a lot of times sheriff elections are like they are elected, but they tend to be low, low voter turnout elections. People don't always show up.
Sorry, Jessica, to break in. I mean, that's not just a simplicity, right? Like that's a choice. You want a low turnout election because you're more likely to be reelected in that situation.
Yes, that's right. I mean, they do it totally on purpose. They make local elections off cycle. So because it would make more sense to just vote for president and senator and your local county board and your sheriff and your district attorney, but that's not what they want. So they'll make these like off cycle elections intentionally to depress voter turnout. And again, I would ascribe that to this sort of link between what I sometimes call like the local petty bourgeois. You know, a lot of places concerned about their sheriffs, they tend to be people who are more rural or suburban, and they have their own right power structure who are sort of like, these are our petty bourgeois, and they want to put in place the local leaders that they think will benefit them. But because they're politicians, what that gives sheriffs is this opportunity to talk about politics, which they'll do all the time. And a relatively more recent phenomenon, I think, since 2016 has really been sheriffs supporting Donald Trump in particular. So when you think about it, there's not a lot of reasons why locally elected officials would bother with national politics. Like there's no reason. And for a very long time, sheriffs weren't linked to national politics. They didn't support presidents. They didn't really worry about senators. They sometimes they didn't even run as a partied official. They'd run as unaffiliated. And you had a lot of like people running as Democrats who were like pre-realignment Democrats, right? So you had like Southern Democrats running for sheriff who were conservative Democrats, right? Which is now around 2016, right? This realignment again, I think happened again, where local officials switched parties. So like people who were kind of conservative Southern Democrats all switched parties to become Republican. And then they would say they supported Donald Trump and they supported right Republican policy. So I do think there was this really interesting, like massive alignment of sheriffs and leading to most law enforcement generally all aligning with the GOP, which kind of wasn't something that happened before. Honestly, because, you know, for example, when Mitt Romney ran for president, a lot of law enforcement did not support him because he was critical of unions. So they did not support. Now, they did not support Barack Obama, but they also did not support Mitt Romney, right? So the way they dealt with most of this was by not supporting any presidential candidate. And I think that as politicians, you know, the thing that sheriffs bring is a lot of credibility, particularly given that the Republicans and Donald Trump have made things like crime and immigration their big issues. So if crime and immigration are your kind of big ticket issues and people are feeling anxiety about crime and immigration, well, it makes a lot of sense to bring sheriffs into the politics because they, you know, are considered like experts in crime and immigration because they would say, well, that's what we do all day. We're like experts in what's going on the street. They become these very like useful avatars of basically the ideologies that I think Trump and Republicans and kind of the right wing, you know, there's a whole complex also of right wing YouTubers and streamers and all this stuff. And they also like tend to go to county sheriffs as like this person who is an expert in, you know, they're an expert in what's going on in their county.
And so that's interesting to me because that's kind of a blend of this old West type nostalgia. And we'll talk about that with Arizona Sheriff, I'm sure, soon, but also this progressive idea of expert management blending in the figure of the sheriff, where you have sort of the masculinity of the old West and this techno expert. You're the one who really knows the area thing going on there. And I think a crucial element of this is COVID. Can we talk about COVID and this idea of the constitutional sheriff? That's when I remember hearing about sheriffs in the 90s with the LAPD and police violence. And then I didn't really hear about them except vis-a-vis Wyatt Earp for 20 years plus 30 years. Oh my God. And then COVID returns and all of a sudden we're talking about constitutional sheriffs. So what the hell is a constitutional sheriff and what is COVID?
Wyatt Earp, who couldn't get elected sheriff, actually.
Yes.
Fun historical fact.
No, he couldn't. Yes, he did. He couldn't. He tried very hard. I know. I always think of Wyatt Earp as the sort of like, right? He's like anti-hero become lawman.
Yeah. Lawman become anti-hero. I mean, the only reason I know this, I've just been watching actually quite a good Wyatt Earp doc on Netflix. Yeah. And it's the lawman becomes anti-hero, becomes Hollywood consultant. The classic tale as old as time.
It's a classic story. That's what a lot of sheriffs still follow. So, you know, during COVID, so I had the same experience, right? I was like working and reporting on sheriffs and COVID happened. And this is when, I mean, in essence, what happened when COVID occurred was that there was a large number of people, particularly people in rural and suburban areas. And I want to say I'm using kind of rural really loosely, just so people don't yell at me, because there's, you know, mixed rural, there's like different kinds of rural regions and not everything.
No, don't worry. They'll yell at you anyway. So don't worry. No,
I'm using it. So sometimes they say rural and suburban to be like, you know, talking about like a category of non-urban areas. And a lot of sheriffs, I mean, honestly, from my point of view, what really seemed to happen is a lot of sheriffs didn't know what to do. So, you know, governors started to issue orders requiring people wear masks, closing businesses, and then kind of asking law enforcement to enforce some of these laws because, again, there's not really any other button to push but go get cops to, like, tell people not to have, you know, like, Thanksgiving dinner or whatever. And, you know, what happened was in a lot of these areas, there was just massive resistance to COVID rules. There was resistance to closing businesses. People thought it was government overreach, which, you know, everybody hates government overreach by its very nature. People felt, you know, they sort of, the narrative that became common in these areas was like, well, the government doesn't want us to work. They're preventing us from, you know, earning a hard day's living and they're trying to keep us down. And the sort of snooty elites, you know, who run the state, many of whom were honestly Democrat governors or people like Gretchen Whitmer, right? They're like these elites in the state houses, they don't understand like the problems they're creating. And so sheriffs, as their sort of like local representative, were confused at what to do. And they didn't really, I think also they didn't really want to enforce these laws, just as like a point of fact. They didn't want to be doing it because it looks bad and nobody likes it. So nobody wants to tell the county barber that everyone loves to shut his barber shop and like go home. So they started to kind of band together and flock to this movement called the Constitutional Sheriff Movement. And the Constitutional Sheriff Movement has been around a long time. I mean, it's really a relic of like the militia movements of the 80s and 90s is just the gist of it. And the idea of this movement is that sheriffs are sort of divinely, they have a divine job. Like it's not just like they ought to, but it's like they must. Their job is to interpret the Constitution in the way that's most faithful to kind of what the founding fathers intended in some, you know, some way, shape or form. And what that really amounts to is something like what I would call how not much different from like the originalist Supreme Court, right? They're kind of like, what would the founding fathers in 1776 have thought? So there's this big reliance on the first 10 amendments, like the Bill of Rights, which of course excludes, you know, equal protection, you know, excludes income tax, it excludes women voting, you know, and there's a big emphasis on things like private property rights, the right to practice religion, gun rights and sort of this idea of like the government should stay out of your business, which is where I felt like COVID kind of fell into. Like COVID was interfering in people's personal business. And in some places, cases, right, required vaccinations do feel like you're getting a vaccination. It's literally like the government is telling you to get this vaccination. And if you don't want to, because you don't like vaccinations, well, that feels, it feels oppressive to you. And so they decided that, well, if we sort of band together, revive this kind of old militia style thinking, we could say, well, we oppose COVID rules. And I think that it had just a lot of popularity. Like people really thought, oh, okay, here's a local government official who's going to help us. And so they started to attract all kinds of, you know, basically anti-vaxxers, anti-maskers, lots of groups of mothers who didn't like school closures, right? They wanted schools to reopen. They opposed children wearing masks, right? This was very upsetting to them. And then, of course, they started to oppose like vaccinations. And, you know, sheriffs kind of inserted themselves in and started to post, I mean, some of the more like egregious stuff was they started to argue that they were like experts in the containment of COVID and vaccinations, right? So sort of like masks don't work. I learned that, you know, I'm an EMT and I know masks don't work. This is a common one. I saw someone pass out when they got the COVID vaccine, right? That was another one. And they would post like COVID is bad and COVID vaccines are bad and nobody should get the COVID vaccine. I mean, and then probably to make it worse is that in carceral settings, sheriffs are the experts in medicine and the people there don't get a choice. So there were also kind of jails and carceral institutions where sheriffs and the doctors they hired would, for example, give people ivermectin. And in some places they gave them ivermectin without telling them what it was. Which seems bad and wrong, but they would sort of, you know, generate more, you know, use that power to tell people, oh, well, you're under my surveillance, so you're going to take what I think is good medicine. And I think good medicine is ivermectin because we don't want COVID to spread in carceral facilities, which it did anyway. And so I think that that just really revitalized this sense of what some people kind of call anti-government. And it is anti-government, but it's really kind of more like anti-elite. Right. Anti the idea that, you know, Dr. Fauci knew the best. Right. It's sort of this opposition to like what in their eyes were elite liberals who, you know, said they knew what was best, like wear a mask, stay home, don't do this, don't do that, don't question Dr. Fauci. And this sort of made them feel like really kind of almost more like a class war. You know, and there's reality to it, right? Like people like me, like I could work at home. It didn't have a huge impact. A lot of people who had desk jobs could work at home. And then there were people who could not work at home, right? And then there were people that sort of got deemed like essential workers who didn't get a choice about whether to work at home. And then there were places, businesses that had to close. A lot of this began to circle around places like gyms and hair salons or barbershops, because those were all deemed like non-essential and had to close. And so they became like sites of resistance where, you know, the sheriff would make a big show of like, I'm going to go get my hair cut. You know, I'm going to get my hair cut at this place because this is like my local barber or whatever. Right. And, you know, the sheriff's sort of self-appointed posse, which was usually like some kind of militia style people would come and bring their guns. And so it, right, it sort of had this like immense populist advantage to people to have, but also they had a legitimate figure. Like the sheriff is real police, not like, you know, the Oath Keepers believe they're real police, but like the sheriff is real police. And if the sheriff's like, well, I'm not going to arrest you, you are like, yeah, now I'm empowered to do what I want, and this sheriff will actually not arrest me.
When you get the Planet Fitness Black Card, you can bring a friend anytime you work out. And now through March 13th, get your first month free when you join. You heard that right. Conquer the stair climber with your partner in climb. Enjoy a post-workout recovery session in the hydro massage. And do it all again with access to any of our 2,700 convenient locations. So, you coming?
Get your first month free and all the perks with the PF Black Card for just $1 down, $24.99 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends March 13th. See club for details.
Can we talk a little bit more about where this idea comes from, that the sheriff is somehow the highest office in the land? It's such a strange thing for people who claim to be constitutional originalists, because you would think if the founding fathers had meant for whatever guy you elect as the county sheriff to be the most powerful man in the county and be able to overrule federal law, that they would have written that somewhere in the Constitution. It's not there as far as I know. So where does this idea come from that somehow this little office that we have at the county level is magically empowered to overrule whatever, you know, anybody at any other level of government says?
I mean, a lot of it, the roots of most of it come from the sort of rural, like, anti-government militia movements that began around the 60s and 70s and kind of hit like a militia peak in the 80s. So, you know, around the 60s and 70s, there were various forms, I think, that of what we would call kind of like anti-communism. Right, you had the 50s, 60s, and 70s, what we would call like anti-communism. There was a rise in this far-right John Bircher Society style of political thinking. And while it was considered kind of far-right, not, you know, in the political mainstream, it was certainly there. And in many pockets, it was really, really popular. And one of the places where this ideology got really popular was in the kind of Midwest and West, where it became something more related to farmers and the use of land. And, you know, and to be fair, right, in the 80s, there was what some people call like the farm crisis, right? People started to lose their farmland because they were foreclosing, right? There were foreclosures. People started to lose their farmland. And this was, you know, a genuine like economic crisis for people in the Midwest. And it made them really angry. And so what they started to do was flock to these ideas that were already percolating that were very, there was one version called posse comitatus, which was basically the idea that people could form their own like little posses, kind of run your own mini government. There's groups of people called sovereign citizens who believe this too, right? Sovereign citizens kind of believe that you could set up like your own alternative government and invent your own alternative laws, you know, and a lot of what these posse comitatus and sovereign citizens focused on was like telling people they didn't have to pay their taxes or telling people that foreclosures were fake and sort of suggesting that, you know, legal expertise didn't reside in, you know, the fancy pants people in Washington, D.C. or the state capitol, but you could do your own law, right? The law is for everyone. And over time, they began to rely on the county sheriff. Now, to be clear, like in the early versions, the sheriffs were not like into it. Like they were into sheriffs and the sheriffs did not love them back. So they would wear, you know, people would form posses and wear little stars and ride around and say they were the sheriff's posse. They did a lot of stuff. They broke up a lot of union activity. That was one of the things they really didn't like. So when there were strikes, farm worker strikes in the Central Valley of California, posse comitatus would like ride in with their stars and be like, we're the posse and we demand this, you know, this stop right now. But they also align themselves with a lot of bank robbers, people protesting seizure of property. And so law enforcement was not that into them. They saw them kind of as a menace, like basically sort of like an armed gang that was like running around. They were portrayed as unpredictable and kind of violent because they were usually did have guns. Now, what happened over time is that these ideas about, right, we could form our own militia, we could form our own posse, they sort of got more, honestly, they just got more popular and like entrenched in American culture. And then at the same time, law enforcement became more militarized, right? So in the 90s, we just saw law enforcement get more equipment. And this has been like pretty well documented by like multiple historians of police, that police started to get big guns. They started to get tanks. They started to use kind of the warlike methods to do policing, right? So you saw like SWAT teams and, you know, various kind of uniformed agents. And so in the 90s, there were multiple events where law enforcement honestly just, I mean, they messed up and killed people, right? So Ruby Ridge in 1992, right? The police wanted to arrest this guy who was kind of a survivalist white supremacist. They basically did like a botched raid. They killed his wife, his baby, his dog. And, you know, people from the right were really, really mad about it. They came out, right? The militias came out and started saying like, well, look at the police, they're killing us. And then shortly after that, there was Waco, right? They were like, look again, the police are after us. The police were killing us, especially federal agents. And so some local sheriffs, like particularly in Waco at the time, said, you know, like, had I been in charge, we would not have had this much death. Had they gone to the local law enforcement who, you know, knows the people, understands their like particular ideologies, we could have had a more peaceful resolution, right? But because the federal law enforcement came in with their like big guns and cannons, what we had instead was like basically we had the killing, we had, you know, mass murder instead of like a peaceful resolution. And so from that, some sheriff, some law enforcement got this idea that like, well, what if we joined militias, but kind of set ourselves up as leaders? And one of the sheriffs who did that was Richard Mack, who is an ex-Arizona sheriff who set up what most people think is the largest constitutional sheriff organization. And he calls it the Constitutional Sheriffs and Peace Officers Organization. And he, Peace Officers Association, sorry. And he just thought, well, what if we put sheriffs in charge of militias? That seems like a good idea. And also it'll be good for sheriffs. Sheriffs will be able to say, sheriffs will say they get more power. Sheriffs are real law enforcement. And also, you know, we can kind of sell this as like a way to like calm down the militia movement, right? Like we'll calm the militia movement by saying like, no, no, don't, you know, don't become Timothy McVeigh. Go to your local sheriff instead, and he will like take care of it. We'll handle it instead of like kind of having, you know, sort of like terroristic style violence. We'll just have, we'll concentrate the violence in one figure. And it kind of, you know, it didn't take off right away, but it began to hold appeal for people. It held appeal for the NRA for sure. So then the National Rifle Association decided that maybe sheriffs were like good targets for their litigation. So they began to target county sheriffs as like a way to sue over gun restrictions. And it kind of slowly built up some amount of local credibility, right? And again, I would say like it was popular with sheriffs because they told sheriffs, well, you can do what you want. Like you're the boss. And a lot of sheriffs thought, well, like, yeah, I am the boss. Like, I like that. Nobody can tell me what to do. It seems pretty good, right? It's a good deal. You know, and this did coincide. Like, and again, the idea didn't come from nowhere. Like in the South for a very long time, county sheriffs were really powerful. Like the sort of powerful county sheriff has been like a trope in, I mean, honestly, it's been a trope in media for like, you know, since the end of the Civil War. Northern newspapers wrote about like the powerful racist Southern sheriff who like has an iron grip on the community. That's been like a popular trope for a really long time. You know, with some amount of truth in it, you know, also a way for kind of Northerners to sort of displace racism and be like, well, it's these racist Southern sheriffs. It's, that's not us. Like those guys over there or down there, they don't know what they're doing. Something I still think people do quite a lot. They'll be like, well, yeah, there's these like racist constitutional sheriffs like out there in the West, but not us. We in the cities are sort of like, you know, we are the normal sheriffs and we do things in a normal way and we don't hang out with these like guys running around, you know, claiming they're the highest law in the land.
So I have to ask, like, what the hell is going on in Arizona? Because you talked about Mac, but, you know, not to, I'm always loath to contradict Danny because he'll dock my pay for it. But the Uber figure to me in this movement of the all powerful sheriff is not anybody having anything to do with COVID. It's Joe Arpaio. So how important is Joe Arpaio? Let's talk a little bit about him and how important is he to this movement to make the sheriff whatever it is, to make this special branch of government that's the county sheriff alongside the, you know, executive and judicial and legislative.
I mean, honestly, Joe Arpaio was really important for, if not one major reason, which is that he had a big sheriff's office. Now, because a lot of these constitutional sheriffs, like, look, they had small offices. They have like 20 employees, right? 20 to 50 employees. They are like small potatoes. What happened when Joe Arpaio kind of got elected and then decided that being a constitutional sheriff fit what he was trying to do? I mean, he just had he has the biggest sheriff's office in Arizona. I mean, he has millions of dollars, you know, hundreds of thousands of employees. So just the amount of kind of damage he could do as an individual was greater. Right. Like if I talk a little bit in there about a sheriff named Darleaf in Michigan. The thing about Darleaf in Michigan is he has like 8 employees. So the amount of damage he can cause with 8 employees is actually a little bit limited. He can't just build a tent city as much as he might like to. He doesn't have the budget for it. Joe Arpaio has the budget. And so Joe Arpaio began to embrace a lot of the constitutional sheriff ideas, right? That he was the highest law in the land. There's also like an intense strain of xenophobia in the constitutional sheriff movement. So he was able to say, oh, well, I'm also anti-immigrant, you know, and over that time period, there's also the rise of the Tea Party and this kind of anti-Barack Obama Tea Party politics, which is where Joe Arpaio got the idea to, you know, investigate the birther conspiracy. And so Joe Arpaio assigned actual like police to investigate, to go to Hawaii,
right? Like he sent people to Hawaii. He's the sheriff of Maricopa County and he's sending people to Hawaii.
He sent real people on the company dime to Hawaii to investigate.
Only in America.
The birth certificate, and gave like a 45-minute press conference all about how that Obama was not born in the United States. And to this day, there are like multiple sheriffs I talked to who still believe it. Like, I was surprised. I thought it had been settled. And I talked to a sheriff and he said something like, well, you know, Joe Arpaio was great because he figured out that there was no birth certificate for Barack Obama. And I sort of like blinked for a minute and I was like, no, I think that was pretty much settled. And he was like, no, it wasn't. Joe Arpaio was extremely persuasive. I disagree with that. It was like, oh, the first, like, really, he was kind of like the first, like, alternative news in some ways, like the first disinformation campaign. And the other thing is Joe Arpaio was really invested. I mean, I do think there's a lot to say about his investment in media. Like, he hired a really popular TV anchor to be his media person. And he very closely controlled all of his media and all of his stunts and every kind of event was like very carefully choreographed. Like he would have, like require people to like dress up in like the stripe uniforms with the chains for his press conference, like specifically for the visual. Like he was one of the sheriffs who I think like really started to understand how media could help. And he understood that like, the constitutional sheriff movement could also help. Now, what I will also say is the constitutional sheriff movement loved Joe Arpaio because he's like their biggest, I mean, he's like the Uber sheriff. Like they have like the most talked about sheriff in the country is their dude. They're like, yeah, I mean, so they're like, of course they loved him. They gave him he was like their superstar. He's like, you know, whatever, like the, whatever, I don't know sports very well, but like if you have like your best quarterback, he was like their star quarterback sheriff. And so they used him to say, hey, this is mainstream. Look at this guy. He's on TV and he's a constitutional sheriff and people keep voting for him. So, you know, and more, I think even more interestingly about Joe Arpaio is like multiple Democrat officials, there were multiple Democrats who did not stop him. Namely Janet Napolitano, multiple officials were not Republican officials who knew exactly what Joe Arpaio was doing because it was on TV, didn't bother to stop him. Like, it took a really long time for local organizers to gather enough like evidence of racial profiling for the Department of Justice to actually bring a lawsuit. But people kind of sat around like watching him do what he was doing and didn't intervene, which honestly just like further fed the idea that like he was the highest law in the land. Like, nobody told him to stop. He just kept going and going in this sort of unlimited way. And even when he was, I mean, now, of course, you get to the sort of like sad end, which is like, even when he was stopped, he was finally unelected. He was prosecuted, right? Donald Trump sort of intervened to pardon him, right? As a sort of what does... is hard not to read that as like a really explicit like endorsement of his, of Arpaio's, not just Arpaio's policies, but like a lot of Arpaio is like a super, you know, uber sheriff kind of thing.
How do sheriffs relate to militias?
Well, it kind of depends on, well, relate is sort of the operative word. I think that what, and it depends on where they are. There are a certain number of sheriffs in many places who honestly like either work with militia members directly or are militia members. I mean, we know like the sheriff of Riverside County, California was an Oath Keeper. I mean, he is a militia member, and he does work with people who are militia members, right? So some of them are more explicit. I think that some are less explicit, but what happens is the weird kind of camaraderie, which is to say that during the 2020 racial justice uprisings, a lot of militias came out of the woodwork being very defensive of the police, because militias view themselves as legitimate police. Like, they really, it's like very ingrained in them. Like, they, if you ask them, they are like, well, we're good guys. We're police. We're helping the police. We're like the thin blue line protectors. And they viewed Black Lives Matter protesters as bad, right? Bad Antifa causing disorder. Like, they're the cause of disorder in our communities. And so sheriffs honestly began to see militias as like dudes on their side, because they're like, yeah, we like love the police. We represent you and Black Lives Matter, but particularly because they saw Black Lives Matter's protesters as not on their side, right? These are protesters against you and what you do, which is like arrest and jail people, right? Arrest, jail, and shoot people. So they're like, well, these protesters don't like us, and these protesters do like us. And so there's just this sense of like, these are our dudes. And that's further kind of honestly emphasized by the fact that sheriffs are elected, right? Most of the militias are dudes in their county. I mean, they're friends. And Black Lives Matter's protesters in some places either were actually or felt like outsiders, right? Not people in the community, but people who had come from the outside. You know, there was all these rumors of buses, right? Like a bus full of protesters. They come from the outside on a bus. They come into our community and then they protest. And by causing this disorder, right? This is like an outside force, like coming in to cause disorder. The militias are like our guys who live here, who want to like retain order. And so I think, you know, while it kind of like blows most like kind of lefty and liberal minds that like militias are seen as like an order creating mechanism, that truly that militias see themselves as like the generation of order and of good things and of supporting the police.
So there's a lot of different ways to go and talk about sheriffs. And I think everyone who wants to get the full deep dive should read the book. But as we wrap up here, could we talk about sheriffs and the border and sheriffs and immigration? Yes. Because that's probably the clearest way that sheriffs as members of the security state, which absolutely is within this purview of the show, interact with our other focus, which is international affairs. So we talked a lot about ideology, and we've implied right-wing anti-immigrant ideology. Maybe we could go deeper into that and talk about how do sheriffs actually govern on the border? I mean, that was one of Joe Arpaio's gigantic things, the anti-immigrant element of his program. So sheriffs, border.
So there's two, I mean, so really there's two basic ways the sheriffs interact with what we might call the border, or at least, like, I would say, like, the U.S.-Mexico border, although sheriffs on the Canadian border get very miffed because they're like, the Canadian border is also very important to our security. But they have two different functions. So one function is as a member of the security state, as partnering with Border Patrol or other federal law enforcement to actually enforce law, something like law on the border. And what that looks like usually is they call them missions. It is all very militarized and security state oriented. So they will run, you know, missions with Border Patrol. They use a lot of helicopters and tanks and a lot of surveillance machinery to look at, and this is literally looking at who is crossing the border and going to those places and attempting to police them, which could look like a variety of things, which could look like patrolling or arresting, stopping cars that they think might be driving people who might be immigrants or people who might have drugs. And then the second way police really interact with this idea of, like, policing immigrants is through their jails. Now, because most people who actually get deported from the interior are people who get arrested and jailed, and there's a new federal legislation called the Lake and Riley Act. And the Lake and Riley Act's intent is to make it easier to deport more people who are arrested. So generally, when people are arrested, the problem is that when people are arrested, what I would call the security state takes over, right? And this was really a structure built by Barack Obama. Like, there's no two ways about it. Because Barack Obama built up the security state, every time anyone gets arrested, they take biometrics, usually fingerprints, sometimes face ID, and they can really quickly determine everything else about you. So do you have, like, a warrant in another state? Are you wanted by the FBI? Are you on a terrorist watch list? Or are you somehow in the eyes of ICE, which could be for a variety of reasons. You could have been previously deported. They could just not know who you are. There's a lot of name. There's also, like, a lot of errors. Like, people have similar names and whatnot. So they just see, like, oh, this person is a potentially deportable individual. And then what sheriffs can do with that information is they can basically turn that person over to ICE. So they're kind of acting as, like, the long arm of DHS, right? They're like your local DHS, which is a little, I think, confusing for some people because that sort of contradicts the, like, local, like I'm your local best friend doing community policing, but also at the long arm of the security state, like, removing people from the neighborhood. But I think that sheriffs see it. I know they see it as perfectly congruous, right? Because again, similar to talking about Black Lives Matter protesters, right? These are people that they can otherize and say, like, oh, these are people committing crimes. They belong to transnational gangs. These are folks that, like, we want removed from our community. And so I do think that there's not really a question that given sort of the plans for ramping up deportation, however that will work, is going to rely quite a lot on these extensions of the security state. I mean, as a sort of example of that, you know, the National Sheriff's Association, which is like the nationwide lobbying group, the leaders of the NSA are security state, long-time security state actors. So the guy who runs the NSA, John Thompson, actually worked in DHS under Bush. And so he has brought with him to this organizing association kind of those ideas of like security state action. And so he uses and lobbies for sheriffs actually to be more like active arms of the security state. Now, the benefit for that is, quite honestly, both sheriffs who identify as constitutional sheriffs and sheriffs who don't both like it. Like, the advantage to the security state is, like, all police like the security state because the security state means they have more power, more policing power, more money, right? And they get this sort of, like, what I think is actually the most important, honestly, about all sheriffs and policing, they get this sort of gravitas and attention, right? They're like a superhuman person, right? Because they're a part of the security state. They're not like regular citizens. They're like super citizens.
I consider myself a super citizen, but Derek won't agree.
Hard pass
on that. Hard no. B minus. So is there anywhere to go forward? Or is this just another part of the security state that's essentially never going to be reformed? We're all fucked and that's that.
I tend not to think that way. I mean, look, when I wrote the book and as I talk, like, I'm pretty upfront about the fact that, like, I think the only path out of this is like abolition, like police abolition. And what I think,
Jessica, don't think that's on the menu anytime soon.
It might not be, but like what I would argue for is that people need to people need to advocate for like less policing. Like the way out of this is like less policing. And I think that what people would think seriously, I don't know, you know, I think it's maybe not on the table right now, but it might be, you know, one can reduce policing, reduce jails,
place like Seattle where like people will be like, we've reduced the police and now there's fentanyl all over the place and blah, blah, blah. Like what's the response to that? The reduction in police has led to whatever quality of life crimes, et cetera, et cetera.
Their mass disorder.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's what people say. So we've got to have an answer. If abolish the police is the horizon, then I think we've got to have an answer to that criticism.
I mean, look, people want to hear abolish the police as like a libertarian, like a bad faith libertarian call. And there are, you know, that version, which is like, get out, leave me alone, you do whatever you want. Like sort of this like kind of like elite bohemians can like govern them techno anarchy. But what you're really talking about is honestly just not investing in the security state, but investing instead in like helping people. So like building housing, building care. This is all like a squishy things that like some people really don't want to hear because you're
they're good. I just see literally no path to that. So this is my criticism. Like, I agree. Those are the things that I want too. But I also sometimes feel like this is where the left critique ends. It's like we have this like 99.9% thing about like this is basically a structure that's impossible to overcome. And then the 0.1% thing of like, but we can imagine the better world. And so I've just been pushing guests on the sort of like that 0.1% part because I don't think we have a good way for how to get from here to there, to be frank. No. In a lot of different issue areas, not just sheriffs, I would say. The one that I focus on in the Empire, you know, there's a lot of like, I hate this line, but that there's that old stupid South Park joke with, you know, the underpant gnomes, like step one, steal underpants, step two, step three, take over the world. So I feel like we need to focus like now we've identified a lot of the problems across society, but I just see no politically strategic path to how to actually achieve anything.
Yeah. And I mean, look, sheriffs, one of the reasons why I was so interested in sheriffs is they were the building of the American empire. I mean, I feel like people sort of have, I think that one, I mean, this is like a small squishy thing, but I'm a writer and write books. So, you know, but one of the things is people sort of assume that like policing is natural and that it's always been this way. Like we've always had police and what police do is like arrest people who we find either are committing crimes or we find them like personally irritating. And that's how we clear up disorder. But it is not natural. Like it was part of building the United States Empire was police. Like, you know, on purpose, they were, you know, what do we do with these guys who like fighting and killing people? Here's an idea. We'll make them a form of law enforcement where that is encouraged. And I think that, you know, when we look at broad concerns about, you know, I think one of the things I'm most interested in is a lot of the talk about like domestic extremism, the idea of like these terror agents, both from abroad and within. All of the language, then it continues to resort to the security state, right? When we talk about how do we hold Trump accountable? Well, we hold Trump accountable through the mechanism of the security state, through the FBI. And I think what we've seen is that's just like a massive failure. It doesn't work. He wasn't held. I mean, at the time I was extremely like, I don't know that this will work, but it won't work. And I think that there has to be, you know, people who are interested in kind of like holding fascism to account have to kind of be interested in looking at how the police are doing.
Not going
to
be the Democrats. Apparently it wasn't fascism to them. They're just welcoming Trump. I think a lot of people are calling bullshit on a lot of that stuff. I think a lot of people just don't believe that people in power actually think these things are existential threats. And I think we're in basically a very, very, very grim strategic moment. I think the left needs to really return to strategic first principles. I think a lot of the 20th century technologies, mass protest, political education are not enough, and they're not working, and they haven't worked for decades. And I think we need to take a really hard look at ourselves. But Jessica, we'd love to have you back on. You are great at podcasts. Everyone, please check out her recent book, The Highest Law in the Land, How the Unchecked Power of Sheriffs Threatens Democracy. It's a really, really excellent book, and I strongly recommend it. So Jessica, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, y'all.
Taxes was taxing. Now taxes is relaxing when you file for free.
I can file for free? TurboTax Free Edition. Roughly 37% of filers qualify. Simple form 1040 returns only. See if you qualify at TurboTax.com/free. I can file for free.
Now this is taxes. File for free with TurboTax Free Edition and get your maximum refund. No schedules except for earned income tax credit, child tax credit, and student loan interest. See if you qualify at TurboTax.com/free.